This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The struggle to recognize women as fully human, with civil and political rights, specifically the right to vote, suffrage, was long and hard in the United States. At various times, the effort allied with other causes, including abolition of slavery before the Civil War, temperance in the 1880s. Those coalitions often tried to suppress suffrage and the suffrage issue to a secondary status. The occasion of the centennial of the 19th Amendment, coming in the midst of the 2020 presidential campaign in 2 years, presents a rich opportunities to use the anniversary for celebration, education, and progress. To discuss the fight for women's suffrage and the possible ways to mark the centennial, we are joined by the acting executive director of the National Women's Party, Jennifer Krafcik. Ms. Krafcik also represents the 2020 Women's Vote Centennial Initiative, which serves as the national clearinghouse for suffrage celebrations. The assistant director of the National Afro-American Museum and Cultural Center in Wilberforce, Ohio, Geraldine Barbie. The Ohio representative to the National Board of the Turning Point Suffragist Memorial Association, Dr. Catherine Durek. And the chief learning officer of the Cincinnati Museum Center, Whitney Owens. We won't be able to take your calls during this segment, but you can email your questions or your comments to talk@wvxu.org. And we're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome, everybody, to Cincinnati Edition this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks.
So, Jennifer Krafcik, let's just begin. What were the origins of the movement and what ultimately brought about the right to vote, that ultimately brought about the right to vote in 1920? Where did this all get started as an organized movement?
Well, women were lobbying for the right to vote from the early 19th century, but then certainly the most sort of popular thing to point to is the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848, when women first officially called for the right to vote in the Declaration of Sentiments. And the movement proceeded from there. The 19th Amendment was introduced it was written and introduced in the late 19th century, and then women really were working toward a federal amendment and toward states' rights for the right to vote throughout the late 19th century, early 20th century. The National Woman's Party came into to play in the latter part of the movement in the last 7 years, but the National American Woman Suffrage Association had been working on the federal amendment and on states' rights for many years before that. The two organizations sort of coexisted in the last boost for the amendment, which was ultimately passed in 1920.
Okay. So ultimately passed 1920, August of 1920, when Tennessee mm-hmm. was the final state to ratify, to put it over the top and make it a national, a part of our Constitution. You mentioned the Declaration of Sentiments and Grievances and Resolutions at the Seneca Falls. I just might point out that that declaration contains mm-hmm. words that parallel the Declaration of Independence, but in a slightly different way. And it says, "We hold these mm-hmm. truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal." And it called for the sacred right of franchise. So okay. Let me ask Geraldine Barbie, this whole movement for the right of women to vote at various times got connected to, allied to, and in tension with efforts for African Americans to win the right to vote. Talk a little bit about the relationship of African American women to this whole movement.
Well, Dan, I think one of the things I would take issue with what you just said is that I think the women's suffrage movement, some of those members were part of the abolitionist movement, but as mm-hmm. the movement for women's suffrage, I think, really took off in the early 20th century or late 19th century, there was this tension between the women who were active. I mean, Ida B. Wells, who's an activist journalist who wrote a lot of newspaper articles, was a journalist that talked about lynching, but she's also was active in the suffrage movement. Mary Church Terrell, again, another woman who was active in the suffrage movement. But they, when the two, I think there were two different, and maybe Jennifer give me a little more history on that part, but there were two different women's organizations that merged to formulate a women's suffrage organization, but African-American women were, in a way, marginalized and shut out of membership, a lot of those associations. So there was this tension of thinking that by bringing African-American suffrage, whether it's for women or men, into the conversation, in a way would derail or detract from the overall movement of white women gaining the right to vote.
So, and I think this, there was a point of real tension with the passage of the 15th Amendment in 1869, where there was an effort to try to make that amendment somehow expand to include women, and that wasn't going to happen for all kinds of political reasons. So, Dr. Direct, I see you shaking your head. Mm-hmm. What sort of your insight into the complex relationships here that are going on?
Well, one of the things that happened in 1869 was that the suffragists had set aside, we should call them women's rights activists, because their agenda was broader than just women's suffrage. They had set aside their priorities in order to support the nation during the Civil War. After the Civil War, they came back together in the American Equal Rights Association, and they sought universal suffrage, the enfranchisement of persons of color and women. They were betrayed by some of their abolitionist allies. Wendell Phillips is famously quoted as having said this was the Negro's hour and the women should step aside. So what happened at that point is the suffragists were faced with this question. Should they support passage of the 15th Amendment or should they pursue women's rights? And that caused a split in the suffrage movement that was not healed for another couple of decades. The resulting organizations were the American Woman Suffrage Association, led by Lucy Stone and Julia Ward Howe, and the National Woman Suffrage Association, led by Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and notoriously funded by white supremacist George Train.
So one of the things that Susan B. Anthony wrote in the later years of the 19th century was, she said, in the indifference, the inertia, the apathy of women lies the greatest obstacle to our enfranchisement. You know, it's one of those sort of insights that we may want to look back and think that everybody was on the same side of this, including certainly all women were on the same side, but it's not necessarily true. What's going on here in terms of the divisions even among women in this? Whitney, why don't you talk a little bit about that?
This is a really interesting question for us as a museum, especially when we talk about things like the relevance of history and what lessons from the past have to teach us today, because, of course, this is something that a lot of groups are still wrestling with. You see the tensions between the first Women's March and the Black Lives Matter movement and arguments about whether the women's movement today and the Me Too movement is as inclusive as it needs to be. So these certainly aren't limited to history. One of the interesting things in the 1800s and 1900s is the way that some of these currents intersect. You have abolitionists, you have prohibitionists, you have nativists, you know, a party founded on anti-immigrant sentiment. And some of them have common values just on one issue, such as prohibition, even when they differ on quite a lot of others. And so you see people, as Catherine mentioned, being willing to set aside certain principles in order to focus on others. And you can view some of this history definitely as a history of compromise, which, again, is something that we're still wrestling with today and we think is a really interesting point to push on as we're thinking about how we interpret the past 100 years of women's suffrage and the intersectionality of things like race and faith and class with gender equity in the way that we teach this to school kids and also hold some common conversations.
That sort of complexity that Whitney Owens just sort of outlined raises all sorts of challenges and potential for how the centennial will be remembered, put together. Geralyn Barbee, you're at the African American History and Afro-American History and Cultural Center. Are you planning on doing something specific in relationship to the centennial?
Well, actually, the National African American Museum and Cultural Center is a part of the Ohio History Connection, which is our statewide historic preservation and history museum, which is located in Columbus, where we have 58 sites around the state. And as an organization, we put together a staff-driven committee of staffers that are working on a statewide women's celebration to begin next year. But right now we're in our planning stages. And, you know, we want to look at this through the lens of activism and women using their voice. And the celebration will not only look at how women went down the path to achieve the right to vote, but also the history of civic action that led by a diverse spectrum. And that's what we're really going to try to tell the stories of, not just the women suffragettes, but again, women like Anna Julia Cooper, who was, and these are actually, and the weird thing about these women, although they lived in Ohio for a time, Anna Julia Cooper, who eventually, lived in Washington, D.C., but she went to Oberlin College, and she also taught at Wilberforce University. Mary Church Terrell, you know, I'm from Memphis, and I knew her name very well because her father was the first black millionaire in Memphis. So they had a different social class, but again, these women intersected either at Oberlin or in Memphis or in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So in terms of our planning, you know, the History Connection will be planning, you know, recognitions and programming in Columbus and other sites around the state. We're working on several things. We'd like to bring in some speakers. But the biggest thing we're going to do is we're opening a quilt exhibit, and it's kind of ironic. The quilt exhibit will honor the life of Colonel Charles Young, a man, but who was a renowned third African-American graduate from Wilberforce and several other, from West Point, and he taught at Wilberforce. Mm-hmm. But the bigger part of that is that the quilts are being created by the Women of Color's Quilters Network, which is curated by Dr. Carolyn Maslin, who's a nationally known quilt artist as well as curator. So it's going to be an intersection of telling a male story in a way from a female perspective. And they're also planning, like I said, several speakers throughout the year. So I don't want to really say who they're going to be right now because we're still working on negotiating that. But I think we're going to have some exciting
programs. You still have a little time. Let's raise the question of how did Ohio fit in to this whole story? And, you know, there's the 19th, there's the 20th. So who wants to take on the various relationships here?
This is Catherine. What I found in my research, I started a couple of years ago, is that all roads seem to lead to Ohio. Ohio kept coming up in the picture. Ohio and Ohioans played a crucial yet forgotten role in the fight for women's suffrage in the United States. For example, this is inescapable from 1860 to 1920. More than half of U.S. presidents were from Ohio. And if it weren't for Ohio, we might not have Wyoming, first place in the United States to grant women equal voting rights in 1869. If it weren't for Ohio, we might actually not have Tennessee, the final state to ratify in 1920.
What do you mean we might not have Wyoming?
So how does Ohio play a role in Wyoming's granting of equal voting rights to its women citizens? The first
long before the
1869,
long before the 19th Amendment, right?
So, in 1869, John Allen Campbell, he's the first territorial governor of Wyoming, his legislature puts together a bill for equal rights, voting rights for women, and they present it to him, thinking in typical political gamesmanship that they would embarrass him. Campbell is one representative of one party, and the legislature is predominantly another party. Campbell surprises everybody by signing the measure into law in 1869. Now, why did he do this? Doubtless, there are many, many reasons, but Ohio comes into the picture because Campbell was at 15, he grew up he was in Salem, Ohio. This is the year that in 1850, Ohio, the women of Salem, Ohio host, and it's the first women's rights convention that is planned, organized, and executed solely by women. He's 15 years old. He sneaks into the back of the room. He's impressed with what he sees there that day, and it leaves him with a lifelong conviction about the ability of women to participate in democracy.
So this is 2 years after Seneca Falls.
It is.
And so it has importance, not in just in a general sense, but because of the influence on a particular person.
Mm-hmm.
So people do make a difference.
Indeed.
What about in the 20th century? We get to 2020, and one of the things Catherine was saying is the importance of Ohio in national politics. Both political parties nominated Ohioans in 2020. Where is Ohio on the question of women's suffrage by 1920? And where specifically is Cincinnati?
So this is Whitney.
I'll
take this. We're really interested in looking at even where is Cincinnati and where is Ohio in 2020 on mm-hmm. some of these questions, using the experience of the past 100 years and how they inform today. So when you think about questions like in which ways have things like race and faith and class played played a role in an influence a woman's ability to fully participate in society, and what does full participation look like? Ohio and Cincinnati specifically is a great place to examine that and other questions, because Cincinnati has always had this sort of liminal place in our national history. It's been north and south. It's right at the intersection of free and slave. It's been east and west, both in history and today. I think that's one of the reasons why Ohio is usually a swing state is, as we know, we have an ability to be sort of a microcosm for larger currents at play. And so Cincinnati and Ohio always had folks who are pro and anti women getting the vote. Many of them, several of them, buried in our own Spring Grove Cemetery. You have Fanny Wright, who was the first woman to speak in the U.S. in public. And you also have Jane Elizabeth Proctor, the wife of then president of Procter & Gamble. Jane was anti, Fanny was pro. And so there's a great intersectionality on both sides of the historic debate to tell here. And we're also really excited about how we can bring that debate to the fore today, to think about how have suffragists influenced women's participation in government today. And there are some great local projects going on around that, too. You're probably aware of the Appointed Project coming out of the Women's Fund of the Greater Cincinnati Foundation that was just announced as an initiative to empower women to serve on boards and councils and committees, because women's participation is still not fully equal there. Only 25% of vacancies are filled by women. So it's clear that we still have a lot of work to do, and we think Cincinnati is a great place to do that.
Jennifer Krafchik, what you have a sort of a national perspective on all this. What's happening around the country in terms of putting together a variety of different types of activities that are going to go into making up what happens in 2020?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really, really exciting. I think a lot of activities are already beginning, as we can already see. But many museums are already planning their exhibits, especially here in D.C. where I am. A lot of the larger institutions here are planning not just exhibits here in the bigger institutions, but also traveling exhibitions. I believe the National Archives is planning something. American History Museum. National Portrait Gallery and others. We're also seeing exhibits across the country. So, so certainly, where I work at the National Woman's Party, we're getting a lot of people reaching out to us to see if they can borrow artifacts and if we can get things out across the country. So that's really exciting. We're also seeing a lot of programs already beginning. You know, things all the way from New York celebrated their centennial anniversary of women winning the right to vote just in 2017, and they're still sort of doing a lot of programming around that, and a lot of really good programs that are into the complicated issues around the 19th Amendment, around voting rights. We're seeing a lot of not just panel discussions, but you know, efforts to encourage women's rights today and sort of highlight the work that is going on, the important work that's going on today that was inspired in part by these women. And I think we're going to see a lot more starting to build. The National Woman's Party and the League of Women Voters came together a few years ago to create the Women's Vote Centennial Initiative, and we've created a website called 2020centennial.org where we're hoping that organizations across the country will sort of feed into this website so that it's a place where citizens can come and find out what's happening in their communities and engage in the, whether it be an exhibit or a program or something completely different, they can engage in that in their own communities. So I think it's going to be really exciting.
I've seen, Catherine Direct, I have seen references to the National Votes for Women Trail. And mm-hmm. What's that?
So the Votes for Women National Trail is an effort to put sites on – right now there's a Google map, so you can check it. It changes regularly – to put sites of significance to the suffrage movement and to women's history on a national map. There's also a part of it that will – as I understand it, there's a part of it that will also – include special Votes for Women National Trail historic markers. So there will be a few of those that are added as part of the centennial. It's a project that anybody with an interest in history who's dug up something, they can contribute to this. They just have to go online and fill out a form and provide a source and a location for the items that they're adding.
So a way to get involved. Now, one of the things, and I'm not sure who to direct this question to, but tentatively, Jennifer Krafcik, since you have sort of a national perspective on all of this, the fact that this centennial is going to take place in the midst of the 2020 presidential campaign, how do you think that might influence, play into that campaign, not the least of which the question of a potential woman candidate for one of the two or both major parties?
Oh, my. All right. Well, I think I definitely think it's going to play into the presidential campaign. I think especially anytime you're talking about voting rights, citizenship, all of that, I think you're going to be it's going to lend itself to conversations with elected officials. I mean, certainly, I think there's going to be a lot of programming around getting more women into Congress and into other elected positions. So I think there's going to be a natural discussion in a lot of the programs that institutions are running across the country and in the efforts of citizens to bring these discussions to the table. So I definitely think that as the presidential election proceeds, you know, those candidates may comment on this. They may be a part of some of these events. I'm not sure. And certainly here in D.C., I have no doubt that we will be. We will also be, you know, hoping that a lot of our programs will focus on conversations around women candidates.
Well, as I went back and took a look at the 2020, the 1920 presidential campaign, there was a real effort by both candidates to scramble to gather in the new women votes. And I suspect there's going to be something similar again this time. I want to thank all four of our guests involved with the upcoming centennial to the women's suffrage in 2020. There are elements, connections on our website that you can go to find connections to this if you want to get involved at this point.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.